Welcome to the Boston Book Festival, the 8 years of it. The eight since, first of all, my name, I'm Judith Gurevich. I'm the publisher of Other Press, and I'm sponsoring this session. Other Press is an independent publishing house, one of the few left. And we specialize in, I would say, extremely good books. And the proof of that, and I have actually one author and one ex-author around the table. And it's certainly a session that is, I think, quite important. I'm going to introduce one moderator in a second. I just wanted to point out that we live in a period that is not an easy one, facing a formidable and ridiculous election. And I think it is not a coincidence that so many intelligent novels today deal with the aftermath of war, because we are still, in a way, in that, I would say, zeitgeist of finding out who we are after so much catastrophe has happened. The choice, of course, is denial, but it doesn't always work, because a lot of things are unsolved, especially World War II. And I think three of our books today are going to deal with the aftermath of World War II. And one book is dealing with the aftermath of Afghanistan. So I think it is a really important time for us to look at all aspects of intellectual life. And novels are probably the one that give us the most pleasure. So to learn while we enjoy ourselves is a luxury that I think we have to really relish and respect and applaud. And I think this is what's going to happen during this session. You will both learn and also find out about the conflict and the turmoil that a writer goes through when he is confronted on one side with history and on the other side with his own imagination, inspiration, and his own subjectivity and his place in the books that he writes. So I'm going to merely introduce our moderator now, and then I'll leave. Catherine Parnell is an author, a writing coach, and consultant who currently serves as the senior associate editor for the literary journal Consequence magazine. Her reviews and short stories have appeared in publications including TSR, the Southampton Review, Post Road, Baltimore Review, and Painted Bright Quarterly. Previously a lecturer on English literature at the University of Massachusetts Boston and Suffolk University, she now teaches creative writing at Grub Street. And I'm, you know, welcome and have a wonderful time.
Day out there, but I think we're going to have a great conversation about fiction, war, and its aftermath. I'd like to introduce our panelists. Some of you may have read the bio, some of you may know the writers. Still, I think it's worth our time to just take a minute and introduce everyone. So, Denny Ellis Bashard, right here, is the author of Into the Sun. He's a photojournalist, writer, and activist whose work focuses on human rights, politics, and the environment. His books include Vandal Love, winner of the 2007 Commonwealth Writers Prize, the memoir Cures for Hunger, and of Bonobos and Men, winner of the Nautilus Book Award for Investigative Journalism and overall grand prize. His writing has appeared in numerous publications, and get this, he's lived in more than 60 countries, reporting from Afghanistan, India, Colombia, the Congo, and Iraq. Michelle Hoover, on the end here, is the author of Bottomland. She is, a reminder, if you don't mind, please turn your cell phones off. Thanks so much. I had to turn mine off. She is a novelist, writer, teacher, and founder and current head of the Novel Incubator Program at Grub Street. She's the current Fannie Hurst Writer-in-Residence at Brandeis, and her debut novel, The Quickening, was shortlisted for the Center for Fiction's Flannery Dunnan First Novel Prize. Big news. Every year, the state of Iowa's Center for the Book chooses one book for its Iowa All Reads program, and they selected Bottomland. applause. Jonathan Rabb, author of Among the Living, is a novelist. This is Jonathan here. Is a novelist and essayist. He is the author of 5 novels, including the Berlin Trilogy, Rosa, Shadow and Light, and The Second Son, a critically acclaimed series of historical thrillers. Rabb has taught at Columbia, New York University, 92nd Street Y, and is currently a professor in the writing department at Savannah College of Art and Design. Kathleen Spivak here is the author of Unspeakable Things. She's a poet, short story writer, and memoirist whose work has been published in numerous publications. She studied with Robert Lowell, and that resulted in the book With Robert Lowell and His Circle, a look into the lives, thoughts, and writing process of some of the most influential poets of the 20th century. Her books of poetry include A History of Yearning and The Beds We Lie In, nominated for a Pulitzer. So let's get started here. We have a lot of questions, I have a lot of questions, and I hope you have some too. But to give you a bit of background, I've asked each panelist to read a few paragraphs from their books, which will give us a sense of what they hope to convey in writing these sweeping novels of multivocality and a panoply of perspectives. All of the novels deal with the shocks and aftershocks of war, and the language of one war bleeds through to another. In Bottomland, Michelle Hoover takes us to the time of the Great War, and along the way gives voice to a German immigrant story in the face of a xenophobic country. In Unspeakable Things, Kathleen dips into magical realism in her exploration of Jewish refugees during and after World War II, invoking some of the worst experiments during the war. Jonathan Rabb's Among the Living deals with World War II concentration camp survivors from a different angle, placing them firmly in the American South, where they encounter radical religious divides and piercing commonalities. And Denny's Into the Sun takes us into the underbelly of life in Afghanistan, where we meet do-gooders who are undone by their attempt to make right perceived wrongs. So let's start with Michelle. She'll read a few paragraphs and give us some sense of what she hoped to convey with this novel.
Hi, thanks everybody for coming. I'm just going to read quickly from the very beginning. So imagine 1920 rural Iowa farmland. And this novel is about the Hess family that splinters from a lot of the German-American, German-American sentiment of the time. It was little more than a month before winter shut us in when I last saw the youngest of my sisters, our little Merle. I woke to find her shivering just inside the front door when she should have long gone to bed. It was dark as a cellar in that hall, and outside it would be darker. Miles of field and grassland lay beyond the front porch. Our house sat alone on the prairie, far from its neighbors. The road to our place was a run of stubble and dirt. Merle's hair shone white on her shoulders, and she wore nothing but a nightgown. Her arms and feet bare in the cold, not enough sense to cover herself, though she was almost grown. I raised my lantern to her face. "Why, Merle," I said, "you'll catch your death." The look she gave as if startled out of sleep. Her eyes teared and she ducked her head. The door was locked at her back. After the war, Father would have made sure of it. A draft rushed our ankles from the doorstep. The rest of the house was still, nothing but a wind outside knocking the stable gate. I touched Merle's forehead and it was damp. She brushed away my hand. Her other hand she hid behind her hip, and when I asked her to show it, she glanced up the staircase and called our sister's name, as if Esther might rush down to save her. I turned my head, and Merle was off, the white of her nightgown a whirl up the stair. In their bedroom above, the two girls whispered together. When at last Esther stepped out, she looked down at me with her dark face, her hands very still where they gripped the rail. Without a word, she slipped back inside and drew the door shut behind her. Later that night, I would wake again and remember Merle as she stood in the hall. What noise had woken me a second time, I could not say. The hall had been cold when I'd found her, though her fingertips were colder. Her nightgown carried the smell of the riverbed. As she rushed away, I saw how her hair clung to her neck, her nightgown damp against her back, and the mat where she stood was dark with wet. When Merle was born, I too was just a teenager, but when first I held her, I believed nothing was so fearsome and astonishing as a child. All the many times we had watched her and chased her and held her fast, brushing her hair, tickling her feet, clutching her hands. As I lay in my room, I imagined again the heat of the flame as I'd held up my lantern. I took the blanket from my bed, wrapped it around my shoulders, and stepped out into the hall. When I tried the front door, it was locked, just as it had been, but the hall was empty now. Not a sound came from the room above. And actually, the speaker, Nan, who's the oldest sister, the next morning when they wake up, the girls are gone. They have vanished from this locked room.
Thank you.
And that's the teaser.
That's a good teaser. Kathleen.
Well, I'm going to read a part about New York. My book concerns European immigrants, refugees, intellectuals coming to New York, and the time period is the last year of the war. The setting is the New York Public Library, where the main character schemes. So here is New York from the point of view of the refugees. Can you get the light here? Well, New York, New York, city of dreams, New York, like a brace of trumpets, welcomed them. I've got to find a place to be in the light here, but never mind. It welcomed them, received all them, the immigrants. They poured into, oh, thank you, that's perfect. Should I hold it?
I can hold it.
They're all
okay.
Holding.
Okay. Did you get that one?
Yeah.
There you go. You're all set.
Oh, you get two.
No, this
go
is better.
Go
this is better.
That
can you hold
fine?
It?
I can hold it right here.
Okay,
go ahead.
Thank
go
you.
Ahead.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
They poured into her huge maw, just as the steam poured out of the smokestacks of the large ships that had brought them there. New York, city of welcome. The trumpets screamed in unison, held to the large, smiling mouths of sweating musicians. The sailors sweated in the engine rooms of the large, ungainly steamships. New York, city of refuge. New York, city of hope. The strident avenues streaked across the city, silver, fiery arrows like long, bright sounds, almost too much for the ear to bear. And still the band played louder, more volume, New York, and the gleaming saxophones entered in chorus. New York, and now the trumpets rose to a wail, a cry of pain, and the saxophones sang of darker things, sadness, nostalgia, New York, city of dreams left behind, New York. The immigrants sighed for the gray, deceiving light of their native lands. Am I too close to my mic? Is it making a little sound?
You're fine.
Yes, okay?
Good.
Okay. Okay. I'm just going to go back. Here, unlike in their native Europe, the skies were blue and clear. The sun shone, jabbing at them through the cold. Snow fell in the city, and for a brief time, the snow sparkled in clean light. Ooh, sorry, that was my. The sky was blue as a cantata. There was some rain, of course, but never the low skies of Germany or Austria or Russian or Poland. The immigrants sighed for the gray, deceiving light of their native lands. They longed for the cloak of darkness. They had gotten into the habit of scheming. Underground life, in a certain way, suited them. They were not fit for direct light. New York fixed its pitiless gaze on their struggles and laughed.
Thank you. Thank you.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Jonathan?
Okay, hold on.
Wait, I'm not sure anything
about.
I too am just going to read from the beginning. I think that's the easiest. Otherwise, I'd have to take you through so many different things. And if I've done my job right, I don't have to tell you anything before I begin. Except I'm going to use my phone. I apologize. Now I'll hold it a second. Yitzhak Golda pressed his sallow brow to the glass and stared out at the slowing platform. It was late summer, and he felt the beads of his sweat gather like warm rain on his skin. Down a ways, a small black boy walked alongside the train. He was carrying a stack of newspapers and barked out the headlines in a voice that was far too low for his frame. Golda had read the papers in New York. He had read them in Washington, Richmond, and Raleigh. He would read them here. They all spoke of America and of confidence, and he marveled at their certainty. Standing there, Golda looked perfectly human. His suit hung crisply on his frame and lent it a heft that wasn't his. He was like a sail, still holding its shape even after the wind has died away. He braced himself for the train's final heave, then took his suitcase and hat and followed the line of passengers to the door. Down on the platform, the smell quickly turned to coal dust and scorched metal. The cement and well-washed marble reminded him of distant places from before the war, the iron beams thick and vaulted. Golda walked and peered ahead and waited for the first glimpse of his future.
Denny?
All right.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks.
Winter was premonition. This is Afghanistan, 2013. Winter was premonition. We knew something was going to happen. We saw it in the desolation and poverty, the gusting indeterminate scraps, the men pushing trash carts, their figures like engravings of the plague, heads wrapped in tattered keffiyehs, or the smog of traffic, wood fires and diesel generators, the effluvium of 4 million souls desperate to heat concrete and earthen homes, mixing with dust in the thin, chill mountain air and hanging over the city in blunt journalistic metaphors, shrouds, palls, and of course, veils. Snow fell, churned into mud that rutted and froze. Pipes burst. Handymen returned to our doors, grim and extortionate, like doctors. Despite our predictions, the country became so inhospitable that the war itself ground to a halt. The passes closed, the Taliban waiting. As we edged into spring, storms tottered on the horizon and swept down over the rooftops without precipitation, gusts scouring up filth, lifting it in long drifting curtains the color of distant rain. At last the downpours came, hailstones as big as bullets, gutters gorged, streets flooded, a season of trash and excrement rising to the surface. Then the roses bloomed, we sighed, even sunbathed, and the fighting season began again. On the night of the attack, spring was still more than a month away, and the taxi carrying Alexandra, Tam, and me worked its way over ice and gouged earth, its shocks creaking, the street dark until we came to the compound's red metal gate. Alexandra had asked us to join her as moral support because she was meeting a man at a party, a security contractor and former soldier. In our circle, there was no less appealing object of desire. No one I knew dated military contractors. The ratio of women to men was so in favor of the former that, for an evening's company, they could pull from a bevy of preening journalists and aid workers. If a lesser woman had revealed interest in a mercenary, we'd have mocked her. But Alexandra was so assured and private that her attractions seemed like parlor intrigue. She was a human rights lawyer who defended women in prison, putting in 12-hour days to file reports of abuse. She told us about girls incarcerated for fleeing forced marriages and how they'd repeatedly given birth during their years behind bars. At parties, she cited studies to diplomats and reporters, naming those in the government intent on rolling back protections for women and those crusading for them. She spoke so decisively that we forgot she'd only just arrived and had learned everything from books and NGO reports. Though I doubt anyone thought of her as an imposter, we all wondered if her taste in men proved a lack of values and a true nature aligned with the occupation we criticized. America's number one export to Afghanistan, Tam once declared at a dinner, is its rednecks. Thank you.
Mm. Nice.
Denis, thank you. All right, let's start with the questions. And as I said, I'm really hoping that you'll have a few questions for us at the end of this session. I plan to leave some time for that. Let's start with, and I'm going to quote Michelle here, I love the phrase, fearsome and astonishing. There's despair, hope, and love in these historical fictions, some of them not so long ago, as well as characters in a constant state of flux. That's emblematic of so much of what's happening in our culture. So the question I have for our writers is, why write about war? What brought you to the topic? Anyone?
You aiming this at her? We can all start.
All of you, yeah. Jump in.
Okay, all right. Why did I write about war? Well, this is Afghanistan's America's longest war, and it's one that is portrayed in the media, has been portrayed in the media a certain way, and now is virtually not portrayed in the media at all in any way that's very insightful to my mind. And I first went because I wanted to understand it. I felt a certain, if I'm very honest, I actually was at that time I was feeling a certain futility around writing, that I wasn't able to address a lot of what was happening in our country, and I was doing journalism. I started as a novelist, and I always intended to be a novelist, and I felt I didn't really know how to address a lot of things that were happening through fiction in a way that I thought was authentic. And so I went to Afghanistan to understand how I could write about it, and was fascinated by, it was a civilian surge in Afghanistan, when there was a civilian presence brought to Afghanistan to win from the West to win the hearts and minds of Afghans. And I was fascinated by the way that we use global conflicts as a sort of a stage to promote ourselves. Mm. Sort of Americans reinvent themselves, they promote themselves a certain way, and yet we have terrible abuses back home, terrible problems. And there was this contrast I saw, sort of these people fleeing America, fleeing trauma, fleeing a sense of confusion around what it meant to be American, or people fleeing purposelessness and going to a place where they felt they had purpose, where they felt that they could champion something and actually doing more harm than good.
To create new trauma,
and they were so unaware of their own narratives and their own culture. So I guess for me it was, we have a messianic culture, and we have narratives around war that we don't examine, and a lot of those narratives around war have to do with narratives around masculinity as well. And so for me, it was a question of how do I investigate these narratives in a personal way, go somewhere where it's happening, understand it as much as possible, and find a story that would allow us a window into sort of our own delusions about ourselves that we need to grow out of. It's a frontier novel. I mean, it's ultimately the Wild West. It's you go to a boom town, there's a gold rush, the mercenaries, the missionaries come in, they try to create culture, and that's where America identifies itself, sort of that point of conflict. And we need to deconstruct those narratives because we're still doing this. Afghanistan, Kabul was, gold rush, boom town, foreign aid, the missionaries, the mercenaries. And I wanted to deconstruct this narrative to sort of show its futility and to show that we have to grow beyond our colonial imperialist narratives.
It's fascinating you bring that up, because I approach this from completely the other side, because I bring someone who has survived the war. For me, I don't think of my book as a war novel. I mean, it's the after effects, obviously. But I bring a man who has been completely demasculinized in every possible way, surviving a concentration camp. He comes to the United States, and the United States then becomes the one hope for survival. But the people he confronts there, he sees this is the way they lived their lives during the war. They were 3,000 miles away from what was actually going on, and yet he comes into a society where that same kind of demasculinization is going on with the African-American community. Now, he can't possibly understand, and this, of course, is a response to the war, he can't understand what it is to be a black man living in the South at the height of Jim Crow, but he can hear echoes of his own recent past and the way they're being treated, so that is ongoing. The war has not really ended. It's there still in this sort of lovely context of the genteel American South. And so for me, it was confronting, I find it fascinating you talk about this messianic quality that I don't know how I would project that onto my story, but it makes a lot of sense. But as you can see, it's sort of flipping it on its head and going to the place where it seemed everything had just moved along so easily. And you place someone into that situation who can see what is really going on in the underbelly of the United States in 1947 in the South. And the country is almost not aware of it
And I guess what I would add to that is, you know, I saw, we don't think of civilians as soldiers or as part of a war. And what, when I was looking at civilians as part of the war effort in Afghanistan, I began realizing that, you know, war begins in our culture somewhere already.
We're complicit.
We're all complicit. And we're also, the violence, any act of violence, any, you know, the book looks at class violence, gender violence, all sorts of different forms of violence. Those violence, forms of violence, and dehumanization allow, they grow, they're planting the seeds for further violence. So it's sort of, we can find it on a micro level or a macro level, you know, if we look at how war works.
Absolutely.
What I was just gonna say, but just, I mean, I see exactly what you're saying, because some of the point that I was trying to make, coming up from the other way, was just, people were completely, the normalization of violence at the time in the United States, juxtapose that against the violence that we'd sort of gotten through in the war, it makes us rethink what the notion of war itself is.
Right, exactly.
And if it does end, if it's ongoing. Yeah. I'm very excited to read
your book. I mean, we're always in the aftermath of war. Or we're within war. It's in its constant cycles over and over again. The reason why I wrote Bottom Lane, it's about a German-American family in the Midwest who the anti-German-American sentiment in World War I was vicious. And people were killed, their language was considered illegal to speak, even in private places. But the reason I wrote about what was happening to the German Americans and the ways in which we turn against people, our own citizens, that we might believe we're at war with, is because the same things are happening now with Muslims. And we're doing the same thing. And it's very much a part of our political nightmare that's happening right now. And I was hoping, this book takes place in the Midwest, I was hoping that some of these people have some understanding of, you know, it will hit everyone eventually. So you have to watch out for where you're pointing fingers.
Thank you, Michelle. That's very good. I would also like to point out that Michelle's book, it centers on two young women. And the two women are suffering because of the war and because of the xenophobic attitude in the country, so much so that they leave home. They're exiles. Now, Kathleen has an answer for us.
Oh, yeah, about writing about the Second World War. Well, my family were refugees, and I was born on a ship just as it entered American waters, and then my family became a textbook family, as so many survivors' families do, i.e., nothing was ever spoken of. Everything was, don't tell the children. They wanted to protect us. There were no newspapers and so forth. I always felt only half American, much more European in America. Of course, in Europe, I felt more American. But and I happened to go to France. I had a teaching job when the Papin trials were starting, when suddenly France was trying to confront their anti-Semitism, their participation in the war in Vichy, the handing in of the French before they were even asked of the Jews. And I began to examine my own family, too, and remembering every little bit of it, what it was like to come to New York, live in a one-room flat, go with my grandfather every day to the New York Public Library while he had been a minister of finance in Vienna and had embezzled funds to get safe houses, and now he was embezzling and cooking up deals in the New York Public Library. So I began to remember things. I began to remember my central character, the rat. It's based on a true woman who shared my bed, my cot, and had been sold to Rasputin. And every night she would start telling me this horror story, and then she would stop, and she'd say, and then we did unspeakable things, she said. And she'd turn over and go to sleep, and I would lie awake, wondering, what are these unspeakable things? And, you know, by golly, I'm going to write about them sometime.
And she did, and they are unspeakable. But she wrote very well about them, and I do recommend the book. Now, thank you for those answers. I want to move ahead, and I know you know you've touched on this a little bit, but I think that for the writers in the group, this is an important question. Phil Clay, the author of Redeployment, noted that with war fiction, there is always this troubling issue of authority. Experience and knowledge are tricky things. How did you navigate this research experience? How did you ensure you got the details right?
I think this is particularly hard for me. I was very worried about it. A lot of women aren't expected to write about war, and particularly younger women. So I knew I was going to face that, and so one of my characters actually does go to fight in World War I, the youngest son. And so I just did, I read, I researched a lot of war letters and journals by soldiers, and I had to study all the World War I battles and how where battles took place, and also how squads traveled together and where they traveled and what happened to them. It's kind of a nightmare to write about and logistically. But I did what the writer does in Atonement, McEwen. In Atonement, he basically just focuses on one small battle and extends it. And I realized that that was what he was doing as a way to not fall into the mire of war, not fall into all these battles. And so I decided just to focus on one particular, a couple days within the soldier's life. And I thought that was a better way to more deeply focus on it. And it felt more secure for me for getting across his experience.
Thank you. And that and I recall that section. It's very vivid and very realistic.
I picked my character to make my life easier. He's an outsider. He's someone who doesn't understand Southern Jewry, and neither did I. I lived in New York for 20-some-odd years, and about 8 years ago, we found ourselves in Savannah. We were going down for a year, and we never left. And I needed to find a character who would allow me, as he discovered the South and Southern Jewry and that experience, so too would I. What was extraordinary for me was it's the first time I've ever done a book, and I've always done historical fiction, where I could actually interview people who'd lived through it. There are also some wonderful collections of oral history, and, you know, it was fascinating. There was one afternoon where I happened to befriend a man who's now passed away. He died at the age of 97, and he found out I was writing this book, and he said, let me set up a lunch for you. And I went to this lunch, and there were six people there, and I brought the average age down to about 88. And and I had a long legal pad of questions, and I was ready to go, and I asked the first question, and I didn't talk for the next 3 hours. And it was what was crucial there, and I didn't write anything down either, which I know sounds odd, but what they did is they basically, in talking about that period of time, they went back to that period of time. They were living it for those 3 hours, and I got to live it with them. And so what you're basically doing is trying to, for me, very much place this character in every one of my novels. And so Savannah had to become a character, and the only way to do that was to feel that I actually was interacting with it in 1947. So discovering through that and those memories that they had was extraordinary. I did the same thing, not quite as vividly. There were a couple of African-American older people who I got to talk with. They were a little more hesitant to speak with me about that experience. Well, I mean, hesitant is maybe the wrong word, but maybe I was hesitant. Let's just put it that way. I felt anxiety. You know, who is this Jewish New York kid coming and talking to you about what it was like to be a black man living in the South? And I mean, there are certain experiences I had when I first moved down there where a 60-year-old man would turn to me and I'd say, thank you very much, and he'd say, that's okay, boss. And it was very, very hard to hear. You know, I didn't know if I was projecting, if it was my own internal anxiety. So that research was a little harder. But in terms of figuring out the voice of the Holocaust, for me, there is one central voice that is absolutely... it's without judgment, it's a still silent voice, and that's Primo Levi. And I read a great deal of Levi, not just, you know, Survival in Auschwitz, but to find that kind of inner silence in a voice, and then to discover in talking to some of the African-American community in Savannah that the whole world was an inner silence, mm-hmm. at least to the outside, made that connection all the more powerful. But actually being able to interact with human beings who lived in that moment, made that moment real for me. And then I created my own savanna. I will say, and then I'll let other folks, people kept on coming up to me and saying, oh, you'll of course include this, you'll include this. And eventually I had to say to everybody, I have to create my savanna of 1947. Mm-hmm. You'll recognize it, I hope. But, and it will be real and authentic. But because savanna has to become a character, it has to be my character. And that was sitting down and talking to people who lived it was the only way to do it.
Mm-hmm. So it was a question of honoring and even exposing that inner silence.
It's a hard question to answer, I suppose. In the novel Jarhead, he says at one point there's no such thing as an anti-war movie. As much as Marines are watching movies, you know, Full Metal Jacket and whatnot, that are considered anti-war movies, and they're celebrating them, right? And I had, before writing this book, I had written a collection of short stories I never published that were about artists living during wartime. And I'd publish a few of them and think, maybe I'll publish the book. And I kept thinking, this doesn't quite ring true to me, or something's missing. And I had heavily researched all the wars for it, had read many, many books. And what I had realized in the process of writing it was that, I'd say the vast majority of art involving war is propaganda for war. You know, we always think of art as being subversive or against these, you know, against certain forces. But I would say most of the books, the histories I read of war, the novels I read of war, were propaganda. We're celebrating the victories, we're celebrating the battles, and absolutely erasing all the nuance and, you know, all everything else that came, or keeping it almost to the footnotes. And we don't think of how much, you know, painting and how much art, how much music and how much is military. It's the celebration of victories. It's the celebration of battles. And so in the process of doing this, I began to question, you know, how do we really write something that is anti-war? How, you know, what does that actually mean? Because I think that a lot of what anti-war art actually does is say anti the bad guy. You know, like, you know, that they're, you know, The Nazis are bad, and we're still triumphant. Even if we're going to show you the horrors of war, we're still a triumphalist culture. We're always celebrating our triumphs,
yes.
And that makes it particularly hard for us to talk about the abuses. And that's one reason when I read your book, it interested me, because I felt that we have a hard time in our culture. You know, we love to tell stories of the Holocaust because we're triumphant, we're the heroes, and we hate to tell stories about our abuses towards African Americans because we're not the heroes anymore. Or if we do, we reimagine a white guy living in a totally unrealistic time who liked black people and did good things for them, which is mostly bullshit, right? We just know that white guys weren't doing that most of the time.
Correct.
So we imagine this goodness for ourselves in the past that we can embody in some fantasy while we're still constantly oppressing people now. With the book, I tried to write a bunch of protagonists who are ultimately villains in the end, who were sort of carrying the American mission into Afghanistan, and they all die in a car bomb in the opening, in the first part of the book, mm-hmm. and someone's trying to understand why they died, and by the end, the person who killed them is really the hero of the book, in a way, and the victim, the hero and the victim, and the people who are killed really are their own murderers by the end
exactly.
of the book. And so I tried to call into question what heroism actually means, and I still stay up at night sometimes, lie in bed going, well, maybe I should have done it differently. Maybe it's offensive.
It's very complex. I mean, you create the situation where, you know, people are, as we said, people are trying to rectify something, but instead, what they're doing is creating a whole new destructive path, terribly destructive. And
I mean, my first impression arriving in Afghanistan was like the British Raj in India. You know, the white men locked up in buildings with their little fiefdom of Afghans who keep them alive, who serve them, and who are dreaming that they're going to get something they really need from this person, mm-hmm. and this really fraught relationship. And we know these people aren't here to stay. You know, there's this illusion of what we can offer, and we're selling American narratives to people.
We are selling American narratives. Kathleen, I want to give you a chance to weigh in. Because I think that within the framework of magical realism, you're able to unearth some of the things that are being referred to here. So,
well, the book it starts with fact, and then it becomes fiction, and then it goes into magical realism. And I wasn't actually even aware going into magical realism until other people told me because I was so caught up in the in my characters. I lived the characters. The thing that held the book together was music. I had different music for each character, and I would put it on blaring in France. You know, you can do anything until they complain in France. I'd blare the music for whoever it was I was writing about. And I began to research. A central group was a quartet. I call them the Tolstoy Quartet. And I had to research the music situation at the Vienna Orchestra, the opera. I had to find out what Furtwängler, the questionable director of music, did. I had to find out how a quartet could arrive in the U.S. being smuggled through South America. So I think that the research was so fun. It just led me in interesting, really interesting places. Mm-hmm. And the whole, I'll just tell you one little fact that will intrigue you. I found out that Gehring decreed that the tuning of instruments had to be megahertz higher. Now, megahertz is hardly anything, a little zizzle, you know? But everybody had to tune up because he discovered that it made people more irritated, and therefore at rallies, if you tuned your strings up or you got people so nervous that you could manipulate them. Now, that was a very interesting fact, and it was debated in the 19th century. Wagner and Verdi had weighed in on it. But a little facts like that would give me a whole scene, a whole idea, a whole... It was great.
Thank you. Thank you. Good fact. Okay, I have two more questions, and then, as I said, I'd like to open it up to everyone. The first question is, in response to this, this is something that Roy Scranton said, every true war story is a story of trauma and recovery. So all the novels that we're talking about today are meditations on the entanglements between global trauma, war, and personal tragedy. And so in the U.S., as we've touched on here, we have contradictory attitudes toward war. But the question is, how do you walk the fine line of acknowledging and writing about war trauma without dipping into the sentimental? Because that's just such a, and I hesitate to use this term, but that's just such a trigger for people. So how did you do that? And what does that mean? And Jonathan, I am thinking about the scene in your novel where, with the cold water immersion in the camps.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
That's a very difficult scene.
Yeah, my mother won't read it.
But it would have been very easy to...
No. I had to clinically do that. Just had to do that very clinically. I will say the way that you avoid mawkishness is having a very good editor. And I have one. Look, the issue about war, people... we're all going to project onto war. We're all going to project onto the traumas and what we think. And I'm dealing with, I mean, people have been asking, oh, so you wrote a Holocaust book. And I say, no, I didn't. That's not what this is about. But you're absolutely right. I had to fight against that in the book because that's not my interest. And in fact, my main character, that's not his interest. No. And the simplest way to avoid that kind of sentimentality is to not judge your character in any way. If you're judging your character and saying, I need you to feel this and you're doing that and so forth, then you will project onto him or her, make me feel this way. Make me experience it. That doesn't make any sense to me. And I think as a novelist, one of the most important things that you can do is never, ever judge your own characters. And I think I'm thinking of your book. I'm fascinated to read it because if you turn hero into sinner and sinner into hero, you can't be judging along the way. Otherwise, you'll give the game away so early and no one's going to care. Yes, I do have a few scenes that I scatter through that go back to his experience there. But they're all small, insular little moments. They happen in there's no epic quality to them. And I think that was very important for me. Much more important was I had to make him as... stillness is very important in what I do in this book and other books. I had to make him a very still, silent character who you still feel for. And therefore, his internal life was very, very important. But I had to make sure that he wasn't judging himself in terms of everything else that's going on. He lives, I mean, at least for me, and reading Levy, which was extraordinary, there is this real, in order to deal with trauma, you have to know how to live in the present at every single moment. You cannot be dragging that past, and it's a difficult thing to do. It's almost impossible. I wouldn't know how to do it. I made my character do that. But you cannot think about the past, and you cannot be projecting onto the future how this action, how this moment is going to affect those around you. There's a scene where, of course, all the Savannah Jews, they're upper middle class, they go out to dinner with him, and of course, one of them finally says, who's not both, so tell me, what was it like being in that camp? He said, we've all seen the films, and one of the first things that my character says is, well, you have me at a disadvantage, I haven't seen the films. And, you know, and he's not saying that to get back. He's not saying that to slap them on the wrist and say, shame on you. In that moment, to get to that moment so that it has the impact, he has to say it because it's just the truth.
It is.
It's just the truth. Of
and it's a shocking line.
Well, of course I haven't seen the films. And it's my job as the novelist to make sure at that moment that the rest of the people sitting around the table don't get out their hair shirts and start hitting themselves with whips. Mm-hmm. You have to deal with things as the truth. And if you do that and simplify, then I think mawkishness and sentimentality aren't a problem.
Now, Michelle, in your book, you address something entirely different, and I see you're ready to say something, so please.
The difficulty is the division between heroes and the evil that they're fighting against and how oversimplified that makes any fiction or even general thinking. And so I was basically writing from, you know, the evil ones, the sinners, not the ones that were actually, not the Germans abroad that were doing the things to the Americans, but the ones that were easily associated to them and couldn't escape being associated to them. And so that was a really kind of complex place to write from. When I first found out that I had partial German heritage in this Hess family in my background, I was in high school. I was actually doing a national history project on the Holocaust. And I was like, well, that's, I don't know. I don't want to be German. Those are the evil people in my mind. I was young. And so I was interested in thinking about that self-shaming that carries down through generations. We associate ourselves to these large groups instead of associating people as individuals, and we need to be judging people as individuals and not as larger groups. But I also didn't want to make my family to be victims of their circumstance as well. I don't think writing about victims is boring. Aristotle talks about in his books, his book Poetics, you want out of your audience to both engage their pity and their fear. Now, pity is easy. Pity is, oh, those poor people over there. And we can stay nice and clean on our side and just kind of be happy that we're not them. Fear, however, means that, oh, those people are just like us. We could undergo the same experience just the same way they could any day, any hour. And so as a writer, you really want to push towards that fear. And so you're looking for that commonality between the reader and the character, but also making sure that the character is not 100% innocent and is not simply a victim, that they are in some way responsible for some of the things that are happening to them. And I think that draws all the characters towards the reader and avoids sentimentality.
Thank you.
For me, I dealt with the issue more by having my characters the sentimentality is something they manifest in their vision of what they want when they go to Afghanistan. So they're all trying to hold on to that sentimental dream of war.
You embrace that.
I do very much. All the characters are sort of imagining themselves as war correspondents mm-hmm. or aid workers, and they have a very romantic. So, you know, one of the characters who couldn't serve as a soldier because of an injury goes as a teacher, and when he first sees, you know, the armored vehicles going through Kabul and the lights, and he's just, I'm here, and this is the moment. And there's a line in Graham Greene's The Quiet American where it's just like, you know, the waiting to hear the grenade go off in the street, and was that a grenade? And the excitement, and I'm here, I'm a part of the war. And so they're all, you know, they're all seeing the war through the eyes of Hollywood to a certain degree. through the eyes of mass media that has romanticized the adventurers who go there. And so they're all kind of, you know, walking in the footsteps of Henry Morton Stanley and Lawrence of Arabia and these sorts of people to a certain degree, and then running up against the futility of these narratives. And these narratives begin to burn away as they go. And the Afghan character is at first actually caught up with these narratives, and he sort of is dreaming of being able to embody these narratives himself in Afghanistan, only to realize they're not available for him. Mm. These narratives, he can't ever have these narratives. Exactly. And then he has to, in a sense, make compromises to live this American dream that he's been told is possible, and but do something that is very profoundly un-American to get to that point. So it's...
And that's one of the things that's so difficult in the novel, just, you know, for the readers to be drawn into that and feel that conflict.
Yeah, that's the goal. I mean, I still feel conflicted about it, you know? I mean, I had a French publisher who had contacted us and said, we want to buy this in France. And then it's published in Quebec. And then he got to the end and he said, I can't publish this in France right now. Nobody wants to hear this kind of story. Nobody wants to think that the person who kills a Westerner might actually be somebody who had his reasons, who felt justified. And that, he said, just it's too much of a risk for us.
I'm stunned.
You know, so...
Wow. Let's give Kathleen a chance, and then I think we're going to have to go over to our questions, Q&A session.
No.
Sentimentality in the novel.
Something.
Sentimentality in the novel. Is your... I don't think your mic is on.
Oh, sorry.
There you go.
Oh, sentimentality. I didn't think about it too much when I was writing it, but to tell you the truth, I think there are places where my novel goes over the top, to be honest. And I just got carried away, because going from writing a poem, a small thing, to a short story, a little larger, you know, maybe two characters in a short story, to opening up to this incredible fact that, oh, you know, as... Henry Miller said, if there's anything godlike about God, it is that he is able to imagine everything. Well, I think that applies to the novelist. You can imagine everything. And for instance, I have to say that my doctor, the evil doctor, who is like Herr Drosselmeyer in the ballet, or the Coppelia arranger, he is truly evil. He's completely over the top. When I finished with him and I was revising, I begged my editor, I said, I think he's over the top. I want to at least have him, maybe there are a few people he won't abuse, you know? Could I pull back? And she said, oh no, I think it's completely in his character. So I think there are parts where, you know, I'm a poet, so I probably built to a great crescendo. And I mean, I've been on a lot of radio, and one radio guy said, oh, he said, hopefully, is this a dirty book? That was his first thing, AM radio, hope. I said, look, you decide. You read it and close your eyes at the offensive parts. I'm sure it'll be just fine.
Thank you. We welcome questions. Anybody? I can't, the lights are in my eyes, so I'm having trouble seeing here.
You know, I've very mixed feelings about this, and I actually kind of make fun of it in the book. There's a section where the narrator is making fun of the writer who writes a book about Afghanistan in the United States, and her publisher says, why don't you just go to Afghanistan briefly so you have some credibility when we publish this? And he goes there for a month and hangs out with all the same people she interviewed in the States, basically, you know, in fortresses and compounds, in bulletproof SUVs, and then goes back to the States and publishes her book. You know, it's... It depends on the kind of book you want to write, honestly. I think that having been, you know, I've every country I've been to where there's a war, I've read dozens of books, and within a day of arriving, I've gone, oh, I totally had it wrong. I didn't understand it all. Mm-hmm. And now I'm starting to get it. You have a few conversations with people, and you realize how much more complicated it is, how much more complex every issue. So I think if you want to write about a country where where there, you know, there is war, I think it's happening right now, and where, you know, we don't have a great historical record of this yet. You know, it's not like we have 50, 60 years of historical records to really understand this. We're still in a pretty, you know, the media is still very unbalanced in its presentation, and the books are. So I felt it was necessary for me. And when I read people who write about it who haven't been, I can tell they haven't been, generally. It really reads very much as if they're trying to use it to promote themselves.
Anybody else? No? I'm sorry, other questions? Yes.
Just kind of following up on that, I'm interested in the difference between writing a novel about something that happened just a few years ago and something that happened, well, I think yours, Michelle, might be the old, going back to World War I, or even further than that, you know, and to be able to have that distance, and do you need that distance, and what's the difference between, you know, having this very, very compressed distance that you have with the Afghanistan?
Can you, would you mind standing up and condensing the question a bit so people can hear it?
Don't have that kind of distance on. All right. Well, I already did it twice.
Okay. Again.
All right.
And we're out of time.
Not quite.
So, you know, I don't know if anyone else wants to say anything about that, but
it's strange to me that, you know, I've always been called a writer of historical fiction, but I never think of myself that way. I find ideas that I want to play with that matter to me now, that I have an anxiety about now, and I just happen to find something in the past that allows me to speak to that. So the distance from now to then, I mean, for me, I don't even, it doesn't even enter my mind. I know that must sound strange. Yes, there's certainly more of an archive that I can dive into, but I don't know. Do you feel that you need that kind of distance?
Michelle? Well, I actually do like the historical distance. I was moderating a panel earlier about writing about social commentary, and some ways in which they talk about how do you do that is that you obviously have to be very passionate about your subject, but you also have to have psychic distance between yourself, the author, and your narrator and or character, just so that you're not putting all of your passion into their mouths automatically and creating speeches or whatever is carrying you away on those subjects. So having that historical time distance helps you gain some psychic distance in that way and actually be able to see your characters more clearly in all their faults and their strengths and keep it more both a personal experience for the reader as well as an intellectual experience that stays with the reader.
Thank you. Thank you. Kathleen, anything?
No, I was just listening. I think that was a wonderful response. I was enjoying listening to you. Sorry, Michelle.
I can add something just because there is a compressed...
Please, I will say something. Have you spoken about this?
No, you can go ahead. You can...
I think... I love that response, Michelle, but I think that... You know, we're writers, so we don't have boundaries. We break down our boundaries to write, and that means that we really enter our characters fully. That's when you know you're really writing. You're not writing political polemic outside, you know, the character's a chess figure. You know, we're entering the character. We're loving the character. We are being the character. We're seeing from their eyes. So the idea of a historical, that's the background, the historical research that, you know, to make... somebody just did a biography of Marianne Moore and she wanted to make sure the buttons were correct on her blouse or something. That's the historical research. But writing the character, being the character, experiencing through the character is what is going to grab you in a novel, because what is a novel? It's basically character development and change. That is a novel. So you have to forget plot and all those other things. It's great to have them, great, you know. But basically, you're functioning, you're breathing through your character as he or she does the arc of the journey. So wherever you set it, you know, that can give you great opportunities. Look at Wolf Hall, for instance. It can give you great opportunities, but still, you're with your character.
Kathleen, we're out of time. I'm so sorry. Kathleen, I want to thank you for that, breathing through your character. I encourage you to do that. Buy these books, breathe through and with these characters, and join me in thanking our panelists for today. I'm so sorry.